Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dunk, and however you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Erica Waters all about her new book, The River Has Teeth, which is described as a genre-blending contemporary thriller that offers a searing indictment of men who prey on women, while the book's fantasy elements offer a form of revenge and resolution. The broad narrative strokes that address the book's intersections of race, class, sexuality, and gender will prompt important conversations by the readers. The River Has Teeth is not only a vibrant exploration of the danger of letting grief and anger consume you, but it also looks at how elemental and ancestral magic, through intent, comes most often from a desperate need and pain, not joy. We talk about finding inspiration in the age-old tradition of murder ballads, this gorgeous cover, how this book deals with being labeled misandrist, why people who find Natasha unlikable have it all wrong, The River Has Teeth, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, now that we can do that again, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices, and this should be done all year long. July as a month doesn't really have a predominant social media holiday, although July 30th is International Friendship Day, so let's just go with that. Try and be a friend to someone who needs it, someone who's hurting in some way, throw some words of encouragement towards them so they know that they're not alone. Erica Waters grew up in the pine woods of rural Florida, though she now resides in Nashville, Tennessee, where she's learned to love bluegrass. Oh, I hate bluegrass. Well, maybe she can convince me. And she has even started learning banjo. That's cool. Very difficult, I've heard. She has a master's degree in English and works as a university writing tutor. When she's not writing books, you can find her hanging out with her two dogs, Nutmeg and Luna. Her debut novel, Ghost Wood Song, was a Bram Stoker Awards finalist and was nominated for a Yalta's 2021 list of the best fiction for young adults. But she's here today to talk about her new book, The River Has Teeth, which is described as a genre-blending contemporary thriller that offers a searing indictment of men who prey on women, while the book's fantasy elements offer a form of revenge and resolution. The broad narrative strokes that address the book's intersections of race, class, sexuality, and gender will prompt important conversations by readers. I called it neat. No, I'm just joking. Please welcome to the show, Erica Waters. Hi, Erica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Of course, thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, that's a pretty serious little blurb, eh, about your book there. Well, that's not even the summary, but it's right. So thanks so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on your sophomore book. It's always an important one in the publishing world, right? And it's being well received from what I can tell so far. I mean, we're still a month out from when it's getting released, but just looking at some blurbs online, people seem to be enjoying it quite a bit. How are you feeling about it?
So far, so good. You know, it's always a little nerve-wracking writing a book, sending it out into the world and waiting to see what people are going to say about it. But so far, people have been enjoying it, it seems like, and yeah, have been pretty kind in their reviews.
Usually this time you're so busy on your next book, you don't even have time to worry about it, right? So
It's true.
They always time these things just right. So when you're doing marketing for one, you've got deadlines on the other. But no, that's a big one. This is your second published book. Is this your second book? Have you written other stuff before though that just didn't get published?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I wrote two books before Ghostwood Song that will never see the light of day, and I'm okay with that. I really wrote them, you know, to learn how to write a book, to learn how to finish something, to revise it, to get feedback, and of course to, you know, get my feet into querying and learning the publishing world a little bit. So they're definitely, you know, they'll never see the light of day, but I don't think they were wasted either.
I was going to say, a lot of times, you know, I always recommend not, I mean, especially because with computers, it takes up so little space. Don't throw them out, right? At least data mine them. I mean, there must be some good ideas in there somewhere, right?
I feel that way. I think there are some, you know, I would never like use the books as a whole again, but there are things in there that I think one day I'll want to revisit. So I'm hanging on to them.
Yes. Trust me, when you're a, you know, billion-dollar author, you get to write whatever you want, right? So hang on to them.
Hey, that's the dream, isn't it?
All right, first question. Why do you hate men so much? I'm just joking. I think there was one Goodreads review where they accused the book of misandry, and I'm just like, no.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of that kind of chatter of you know, that the book is anti men or that I hate men, and that's definitely not the case.
I assume your husband is aware that you hate men, or are you on actually?
Yeah, I mean. I've been happily married to a man for 13 years. My best friend is a man. I have 3 older brothers. I definitely don't hate men.
You fooled them all. You've tricked them all the men in your life. I was just kind of like, I saw a couple of things about that. I'm just like, no, not really. And here's the thing. Like, if anything you had said in the book was made up or had never happened in the history of the earth, right? Like, let's be honest, us men have sort of had our way for a long time. And, you know, if we're called out on it once in a while, that's fine. But for a woman to accuse you of misandry, that's a different approach, I think, for sure. They're coming at it from a different angle, aren't they?
I think we're not used to seeing books that center women so dominantly. You know, this is a book about women, about what women go through, and men definitely play a part. You know, there's Della's father, and there's her cousin Miles, and there's a character we won't get into yet. So those men certainly have a bearing on the plot, but ultimately it's a story about women and the choices that they make and the way that they survive and support one another. And so I see the book less as being anti-men than just being really focused on women's stories. And I will admit, in this book, you don't see a whole lot of great men. But to be honest, that's a lot of women's experiences. They go through life not encountering a whole lot of great men.
I couldn't have said it better. And I 1000% agree. I did pull a quote that sort of, you kind of end the book with this quote though. It says, "There will always be men in the world who want to control and hurt and kill us. Men who take girls and make them their toys. Men who gain pleasure from our pain." That's sort of how you end the book. That's not a spoiler. That's just more of a general thing. It doesn't tip anything away about how this book ends, and it does have a really cool, wild ending. But and I don't want to, you know, harp on the point at all, because again, I agree with you. And even with that statement I just read from your book, it's true. Right? So, you know, like, if you were just making this up, then I guess, right? But no, you're right. You know, you talk to any woman long enough and pretty much they all have a story, right? So, I applaud you. You know, this is a graphic book, and you get into some pretty dark corners, and I appreciated that, and I applaud you and other writers who aren't afraid to go there and call people out on their bullshit. So
thank you.
Yeah, I'm all for it. And but I just, yeah, I don't know, like I said, I think I read a couple of things and they were saying that, and I was like, I don't know about that. But anyways.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the way I feel about reviews is we all approach books, you know, we never come to a book on its own terms. We always come to a book with our own life experiences and and views. And so two people are going to read the same book and come away with really different feelings about it. And I'm okay with that. You know, I don't expect everyone to love my books necessarily, or to agree with my worldview. But I'm always grateful when readers give it a chance and consider it.
Oh, of course. And I think we all agree that, you know, criticism is great as long as it's fair, honest, constructive, and not mean-spirited, right? We're all okay with that. There's no doubt about it. Anyways, so we'll move on from that point. I think it's fair game to ask, because it does come up in your book, right? So,
it's a valid question.
Yeah, and to your point, there aren't a lot of nice guys. Miles, for sure. Miles is a good guy. We like Miles. This is, you know, the focus, the story is these women and what they have to go through and the things they put themselves through and suffer through. It's a really great story. We'll talk a little bit about the book, non-spoiler, of course, here in a second. But a couple of things I wanted to talk about before the actual book. We'll get to that too, but the cover's amazing. The art was by Chevelle Fryer, and designed
she by did an amazing job.
Jenna Stemple Lobel, who did the design. Unbelievable. There's been some great covers this year, and this is one of them. I really, 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 really loved it. I was sort of just mentioned to you quickly off air that most authors I talk to are cat people. So when I get to talk to one who's got dogs, I have to ask. So tell me about Nutmeg and Luna.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nutmeg is a 10-year-old beagle mix. And she's fantastic. When we got her, she was a little bit of a mess, you know, just really had a hard time. And so it was a big adjustment period. But now that we've had her for a while, she's so happy to be here and, you know, has been with us for about 6 years. And she's such a fun dog. We love her so much. And then we also have a Chihuahua mix named Luna, who is the queen of the castle. And pretty much she runs the show.
Sure.
And she's kind of a little dark vampire queen. And we kind of all just worship her a little bit.
We're living in Luna's world, is how we
exactly
yeah, yeah. yeah perfect
including Nutmeg.
I'm taking my mixed beagle Maggie to the vet tomorrow. Actually, she's got a little infection, but yeah, I got a mixed, yeah, I got an older mixed beagle and a older blue heeler, both just two old shitty dogs who just do nothing but cost us money now, but
yeah,
same. we love them so much.
We love old shitty dogs. They're the best kind.
I don't know, I won't ask. You can offer the information if you'd like, but I don't have kids. We're not having kids, and so these are our kids, and so it's they get all the attention in the world. And yeah, they
same yeah they, yeah they have the child run of the free house.
Yeah. Right, so yeah, they have just like yours, ours pretty much have the go of the house. So but it's always nice to talk to dog authors because there's so many cat people. I think that's just be a lot of the times too, is a lot of authors are either living in either apartments or something, and it's just easier to have cats. So I understand that for sure.
Yeah, I'm a little scared of cats.
Are you?
You know, like I didn't grow up around them, and there's like my family, the family I grew up in is just so superstitious and were pretty superstitious about cats too.
Really?
So I kind of grew up with negative impressions of them, and I've had to sort of get to know a few nice cats here and there to get rid of those feelings.
It's funny, you know, I like having them in the neighborhood, right, for the mice aspect.
Sure.
But I wouldn't want one in my house. But I used to be an investigator for the SPCA for animal cruelty years ago. That was my former job. And, you know, we had this, there was a couple policies we had about on the adoption side of things. And one of them is that we wouldn't adopt black cats out around Halloween.
Of course, yeah.
Because people would get them as like, adornments or you know, decorations, and they'd always come back, or they would just let them loose after when they were done with them, right? So just sort of, I thought of that when you said superstition, because there are some people out there who do stuff like that. But yeah, they would always, and then rabbits around Easter, we wouldn't adopt any rabbits 2 weeks ahead of Easter,
right?
Stuff like that, because people do stupid things.
Yeah, we weren't sacrificing cats or anything, but you know, my family believed in, you know, like the like that old myth that like cats steal babies' breath, you know.
Yeah.
Have you heard that? That was something I heard a lot growing up.
Yeah.
I think we were just generally mistrustful of cats.
Yeah, I don't know. I get it. Because they got that look, right? And that bit of confidence too, that dogs just don't. Dogs have that dopey sort of attitude where, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
They're just right. They have like serious FOMO and just like, you know, and cats just don't have that. They're too independent. We don't trust.
It's true.
We can't trust independence.
I had a really good time writing a cat into The River Has Teeth.
Just, right. Yes.
I thought he was just kind of a funny, like old tomcat, you know, just doing his thing.
And that's his introduction is funny when she sees him for the first time. And I can't remember what she calls him. Like, this thought it was a cougar or something. It was, right. Like, right. When she jumps on the hood of her car,
right.
it's kind of a funny introduction. One of the things I wanted to ask you about too was, so on your website, which is lovely, by the way, I was like,
oh, thanks.
Cause not all authors' websites are created equal. You do some blogging, and one of them was caught my attention, the title, obviously, How to Talk to Writers About Their Shitty Books. So care to comment on that? Do you have some experience in that? Or
yeah, so it was my first book coming out, you know, and I was already starting to hear some rumblings from relatives, you know, the kind of the ones who just want to say, like, I really liked your book, but I really didn't like how you did this, and I wish you hadn't done that. And I could just feel the criticism looming, and I just really wasn't in a place where I wanted to hear it. So I thought that was a funny way to, like, you know, kind of set some boundaries and talk to people about, you know, what do authors want to hear from friends and family who have read their books, as opposed to, you know, common readers. or yeah, reviewers?
It's an interesting thing because, you know, I am friends with a couple of authors, published authors, and, you know, they'll send me their stuff early just, you know, for feedback, right? And they trust, you know, my opinion, but they won't do that to their family. Like, they won't let their husbands read it or their wives or their parents, right? Because they end up inevitably, it's just, yeah, you get into those situations, don't you? And it's, you know, it brings up sort of like, you know, are any of us qualified? I mean, what's, you know, ultimately, you know, calling myself out here, like, what are my credentials, right? to review books, right? Because I do, you know, review them as well. But that's, you know, if you read my reviews, you could, I don't, get too technical on stuff. It's more just how it made me feel, right? But but yeah, no, that's a slippery slope, especially because every family member, I'm sure, is asking you to read it, well, you know, ahead of time, or maybe even worse, have you had this happen to you yet where they're like, is this me? Is this supposed to be me?
A little bit, especially with my first book, because I did draw a lot from my growing up years in my first book, you know? So there was some of that. Or like my mom one time, the main character of my first book, her name is Shady. And one time my mom called me Shady. Mm. And I'm like, oh no, mama, that's not me.
That's funny.
It's just a character.
Right. Yeah, that's that can happen. I've heard of stories like that happening, right? Especially when you know, inspiration is all around you, right? So naturally, especially if you're a big family, it's inevitable that someone's going to end up in there, but or some version of them, anyways. But
right, I think it's little pieces. I think right. Especially for my first book, as I constructed that book, I took little pieces of people, you know. So no one character is one person, but you know, like speech patterns of the people I grew up around, or just, you know, habits, ways of looking at the world, like all of that kind of finds its way in into sort of composites.
Right. One of the things that you used, you know, for inspiration for this book, and you used it on your first book as well, Murder Ballads, was something that's I've seen you mention a few times in some interviews. Mm-hmm. Are you just going to ride that train till it stops or what? Yeah. Like, you're just going to, and it seems to be working. So I definitely wouldn't recommend not, you know, but talk about that. Cause that's an interesting sort of source of inspiration, and one you don't hear very often.
Yeah. I love Murder Ballads.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I really listened to one, like one of the classic.
Because they're stories. Yeah. I mean, they are.
Yeah, they're like stories. And I remember just finding it so shocking. And you know, some murder ballads are just really beautiful and you almost don't realize you're listening to a murder. And then you have ones like Knoxville Girl, which is really violent. Mm-hmm. And like the murder ballad that's in The River Has Teeth is an older version of Knoxville Girl. And I remember the first time I listened to it, it made me a little sick. I kind of couldn't believe that it was a song that people sang, because it was just so violent. But I've just gotten so fascinated by them and just how they allow us to look at darker parts of ourselves, our darker impulses. I love the stories that they tell. My favorite murder ballads are the ones where, because most murder ballads, it's a man who is the killer. I love murder ballads where it's a woman, like Young Hunting, which I think is a song that I reference in The River Has Teeth about a jealous woman who stabs her lover with a penknife.
Right.
So I do enjoy murder ballads and have definitely drawn a ton of inspiration from them, both for Ghostwood Song and for The River Has Teeth. And I'm sure I'll continue to return to murder ballads and to, you know, more generally bluegrass and folk music, because those do speak to me a lot as a writer. But actually my next book, The Restless Dark, which is coming out in 2022, as of yet has no music in it whatsoever.
There's plenty of time. Don't worry.
Yeah. Who knows? I could still sneak something in.
Right. Well, it's an interesting, you know, I mean, that's stuff like that in bluegrass, of course, too, it's such a part of the, you know, down south there where you're from. Right.
Yes.
And it goes back such a long way. I mean, it's all the way to, you know, that type of music, bluegrass especially, and murder ballads. I mean, we're talking the beginning of, you know, this is before Robert Johnston invented the blues, right? Like, this is, you know what I mean? Like, this is, you know, parallels the history of the country, especially down south, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, murder ballads, like a lot of even the modern ones are iterations of much older right. songs brought over from England, Ireland, and Scotland.
Right.
So some of these songs are from like the 1200s, you know, they've right. just been passed down and passed down. And in Appalachia, you just have a lot of these kind of songs that have been brought over and passed on from one mm-hmm. person to another.
Yeah, it's historical reference, right? So
yeah,
you mentioned there that you know you enjoyed the ones by women. How many? Like, what's the percentage? Do you think? Like, what's the ratio of?
Oh, it's really small. I mean, yeah. you know, a handful of ones about women for every you know.
This is a case where that's a good. This is the case where it's a good thing, right?
Like, right. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's the fact
it turns
that
out women don't murder as often.
Yeah,
as men do.
women are less violent right. as a whole, which
and
which
should
I'm
and
for.
Deserve and have every right to be more violent. But yeah, that's one of the categories where it's okay to be a distant second in, maybe. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to be second in that one.
Yes, for sure. What was so talk about then, you know, obviously we just talked a little bit about it, the inspiration behind your books, but this book in particular, what was something that just sort of, what was the light bulb that went off for this book?
Yeah. So for me, I get a lot of inspiration from places. You've probably noticed setting plays an enormous role
yes.
In this book, and it plays an enormous role in everything that I write. But for this book, I was visiting a nature park in Nashville. It's called Bell's Bend Nature Center. And, you know, most of the nature parks in Nashville are just woods, trails. They're beautiful. Bell's Bend, the first time I went, I was so shocked by it because it was so different. But Bell's Bend is more like agricultural. It's like big open fields full of wildflowers, you know, really tall, like shoulder high grass. So it's really beautiful and peaceful. It's full of birds and butterflies. There's so much wildlife. But on the first day that I went there, it was fall. The sky was completely blue and everything was brown and dead. And it made this like shh sound. And there was no one else there. So it was this kind of feeling of being just out of time and place. I felt like I'd been dropped into like a surrealist painting. Mm-hmm. And I was a little afraid. I got goosebumps, you know, and something about the place felt eerie and spooky to me. And that was my first sort of inkling of thinking about a place with its own power, maybe a little bit of its own agency. And so really the story built up from there, from this one experience of this one moment in time in this one place. And so, you know, the park in the River Hess Teeth is not Bell's Bend. It's a composite of many, nature parks in Nashville and other places that I've visited. I've sort of, you know, geographically kind of knitted them together, and drew a lot on Tennessee flora and fauna, and what limited understanding I have of ecological concepts. So all of that, like my experiences of visiting nature parks, were really where I got the first inklings for this story, and everything else came later, the characters and the plot.
Right. And it just works from a, you know, a practical storytelling point of view for the type of story you're telling anyways, because it's gotta be the type of place that, you know, a lot of people just, you know, don't go to, can't go to, won't go to. Mm-hmm. That inspires sort of a lot of sort of gothic, you know, ancestral type, you know, fairy tales, right? And
right.
you know,
to keep
people out of the woods, all that type of stuff, right? So yeah, the place you're in the book is called The Bend. Yeah, everything you just said, I'm just, as you're saying it, I'm picturing how you describe it in the book, and that's pretty much bang on, right? So
yeah.
So anyways, the book, yes. I'm just gonna read the summary because it's delightfully short. If it was too long, I would get you to do your pitch, but this is nice.
Yeah, please do.
This is nice short. So girls have been going missing in the woods. When Natasha's sister Rochelle goes missing on the bend, the second girl disappears from the wildlife preserve. Natasha will do anything to make sure she's found. As the case turns cold, Natasha's desperation takes her to Della, a local girl rumored to be a witch, in the hopes that magic will bring Rochelle back home. But Della has her own secrets to hide. Because Della thinks she knows who is behind these disappearances, her own mother turned into a terrible monster by a spell gone wrong. Natasha is angry. Della has little to lose. Both are each other's last chance. Yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good summary, I think. What came first? It sounds like maybe the idea came first, but you were inspired by nature. But what point did Natasha and Della come along?
Della came first, because actually where I first got the idea for Della is that another nature park that I visited, which was more rugged and hilly, I noticed up on a hill there was just a trailer sitting out there. And I wondered about those people who live there. And I thought, I wonder what they think of all of the like yuppies who come in from Nashville to go hiking here. And so that got me to thinking about, you know, a family like Della's, a family of people who lived close to a land that didn't belong to them, that they couldn't claim, but that nonetheless felt like it belonged to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I got the idea for Della's family. And I don't even know where Della's voice came from. She just kind of, who knows? It's always a mysterious alchemy creating characters, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be for sure. And everyone's different too. Some, whether you're a pantser or a plotter or whatever, an architect, sometimes the characters are well defined. Sometimes the story and, forms the character, right? A big part of this book is magic. It's all over that summary, obviously. And you wrote a really great line in this book, and I like it when this comes up in other. It's come up in other books that have to do with magic, about intent, right? Intent is everything with magic. And there's a great line that says, "Magic comes from need, and kids like that don't need anything." So their mother's referring to kids who are maybe well off, right? Kids who aren't struggling for whatever reason. Now that, of course, flips. That's too spoilery. But there's an interesting there's a nice little twist that you apply to that will eventually find its way to encompass both characters. But intent is everything with magic, isn't it? And I like the way you put it there. It comes from need. It's a real nice way to put it. And I really like the magic in this book. Like it ties in actually with you sort of being, a naturalist in a way, right? Because it's very elemental, right? It's water, it's the earth, it's the flora, the fauna, the wildlife. It goes all about. And what's really cool about it is you form it around this really great ancestral magic, right? In this sort of southern root magic in a way. And usually when we encounter this type of magic in literature, anyways, in storytelling, it's not born from joy. Right. So talk about sort of the idea and maybe how you slowly, pieced together, but sort of came to this, put this concept together of your particular brand of magic.
Sure. I guess the way I think about magic and why it's so appealing to us is that often we feel powerless. And that's a lot of what this book is about, is the feeling of powerlessness. And I think magic, the way it's used in stories, it's often people who are powerless who most need it. Mm-hmm. And of course, powerless can mean many things. That might be, someone who's on the outskirts. It might be someone who is poor, someone who is experiencing violence at home. So it's someone who needs something outside of themselves, something bigger to save them. So that's kind of how I was thinking about magic. And in this instance, it's a family, a fairly low income family that are outsiders, who have this magic. That's the one thing that belongs to them. It's the one thing that makes them special and powerful, that gives their lives meaning. Della's family, everything they are and do revolves around this magic. And then you have a character like Natasha who comes in, who on the surface seems to be exactly like those kids Della's mom told her about.
Right.
Those rich kids don't need nothing. They've got everything they need. Why would they need magic? They can't do magic because they don't need it. So it's this idea that magic comes from need. But in fact, as you'll learn in the story, Natasha is a lot more than she seems on the surface. She's not just this spoiled rich girl. She's someone who's been through a lot, who has a lot of trauma, and who has lost something dear to her. And so her need comes from a different place than Della's, but it's still a potent need. Mm-hmm. And so, this, I think in some ways, like this story, it's more gesturing at this idea of powerlessness. It can't answer it. It can't solve all the problems. But I think it's why we want magic. It's a form of catharsis, right? When we read fantasy novels where someone who is powerless gets power, it's catharsis. It's what we want to see in the world, even though we may not necessarily see it.
Right. But it, to your point, it rarely affects, you know, greater change or the outside world, right? It's unique to that problem, to that situation. So in this case, yeah, it fixes their problem maybe, and maybe only even temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, it, once if they were to leave the bend, you know, like not so much, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. So you have to have something more than magic. You know, right. That's the hope by the end of the book is that you find something that is magic of your own. That's
right.
Apart from, you know, potions and spells.
Beautiful segue. Natasha's not a likable character. But that's okay. It's totally fine. And I'm certainly not going to fucking judge someone's actions who's gone through some of the shit that Natasha goes through. Right. There's just no goddamn way that I could.
Yeah.
And not be honest with myself anyways. Right. Or with anybody else. So there's a, I think I got this from somewhere, this quote. I don't know if it was you said it. Anyways, this book is an affecting exploration of the power and danger of anger and the fine balance of using anger to enact change without letting it consume you. And that's a really, talk about, that's just to your point, catharsis right there. And because Natasha just, she just really gets close to that, to letting it consume her, doesn't she? This, because I mean, she's, her sister, and you know, we won't necessarily talk about this part too much, but her and her sister, they're adopted. I think we're allowed to say that, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Great home though. The adoptee parents are fantastic parents. There's no shenanigans going on at home or anything. But because of that, I mean, you know, they were adopted when they were a little older. So they grew up in the system a little bit together. So they're very close naturally, right? As you would expect them to be, they're sisters. So it's in a way, her entire world is crumbling around Natasha. So, you know, she's a mess. She's not thinking clearly and she's making some poor decisions. And she's in an emotional state, which I think we can all agree is a bad time to make decisions.
Yes.
But that quote right there about without letting it consume you, and that's where Della comes in.
Is
that balance that she needs and that calmness, which is the exact opposite of how Della's viewed from the town, right? She's they're viewed, her families are more chaos agents, right? They're not a calming mm-hmm. influence on anybody, right? They're weird, they're creepy, they're witchy, they're doing evil shit. So, you know, talk about how far you were willing to push Natasha, because like she's just out of her mind for a lot of this book.
Yeah. And you know, I've seen some readers who say that they found Natasha's chapters really hard to read and difficult to read. And they should have found them hard to read because, you know, Natasha, as you said, is someone who's experienced a great deal of trauma. And she's a teenage girl who's been through trauma, whose world is crumbling around her. Yeah, she's going to behave badly. She's going to take anger out on the wrong people. She's going to be pigheaded in what she thinks is right. And,
sure.
and you know,
yeah.
I definitely understand that she's not likable. I didn't write her to be likable. I wrote her to be real.
Yeah.
100%. Which is someone, you know, going through a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And so it was important to me, to let her have, you know, real, authentic, honest emotions,
mm-hmm.
Which are not always ones that we like to look at or that we like to encounter. You know, people say they want to read books about a diversity of characters, but the truth is that they often don't like what a diversity of characters sometimes looks like. You know, someone
right.
who has been through trauma. You know, we all respond to trauma differently. Some people dissociate and shut down.
Right.
Others, you know, react in anger, and Natasha is one of those people.
Yeah.
So this book was really pushing her there and just letting, you know, her get to that point of anger consuming her,
mm-hmm.
Which I won't give the spoiler, but there's this final scene where she really has to come to terms with, is my anger powerful and redemptive, or is it going to consume me and take everything I love and want away from me? So it is that line. This book is really exploring the line between anger that is powerful, and anger that is destructive. And mm-hmm. sometimes it's a thin line, a fine line between those two things.
You know, like even the summary says there's monsters. This is a real fantasy, you know, type story as well.
you know, sort of embedded in this real world setting. But essentially it's a murder. It's kind of just a murder mystery, isn't it? In a lot of ways.
Yes.
And one of the, suspects of Rochelle's missing, Rochelle's gone missing, as the summary says, and one of the suspects is her ex-boyfriend, Jake, mm-hmm. Who is a real piece of shit.
Yeah. He's a real asshole.
and you know, Natasha just, you know, barrels after him, right? Because just, you know, he's a suspect. He's one of a few suspects. And, you know, obviously it could be any one of the three. And it could have easily been any one of the three. And, you know, the readers will find out who it ends up being. But it's funny, as hard as she went, you know, at Jake and the other suspects and some of the other people in the story, the only time I was like kind of even, I was mad at Natasha is when she went after Georgia and Margot. That was, yes, the only time. It was the only time I was like, no, that's the only people helping you. Yeah, yeah.
I will tell you that one scene where she has that big blow up with Georgia and Margot was the most difficult one to write. I spent more time working on that scene than any other,
right?
Because it was such a, just a teeter totter, you know, balance of, you know, how much can I let Natasha be an asshole before readers give up on her?
Well, right. And then replace readers in that sentence with Margot and Georgia.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. How much are they willing to take? You know what I mean? Because one of the things, you know, one of the lessons Natasha is going to learn slowly is that, you know, like a lot of things in life, you can't do this by yourself. So, you know, the only question is how many victims are going to, you know, sort of fall by the wayside until she learns that lesson, essentially. Right. So that's kind of a big part of the book as well. And so again, a big part of this book is metamorphosis, right? This mm-hmm. this idea that everyone's changing in one way or another. And in your book, there's like, that's, you know, allegorical, it's metaphorical, and sometimes it's just outright physical, you know, like in some cases, right? There's monsters in it. So talk about sort of like, again, the fine line between, because it's a murder mystery, but it's also a fantasy. There's witches. And there's other things, but then there's just, you know, real life shit too. So, you know, what was the idea with it? How fantastical were you willing to go? Maybe talk, this maybe is more of an editing question.
Yeah. And that's an interesting question. You know, my first book was also kind of the same thing, a contemporary mm-hmm. fantasy slash, you know, kind of supernatural thriller murder mystery. So, and my third book's kind of circling similar ground. So it's definitely... it's definitely a way of writing that appeals to me a lot. I think,
is that what you like to read?
Yes. I love reading things like that. Like Saul Kilgirls, for example, mm-hmm. is a great example of kind of, you know, what I want to be writing.
Right.
I think that book is nearly perfect. I forgot the question. What was the question?
Oh, sort of like how far you, the fantasy element and, you know, in editing, was it ever, did it, you know, did it have to be?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So, you know, I always want it to be a fantasy, you know, and it is, it's hard to hold all those pieces in balance. And I think I did a better job of it with this book than I did with my last, of learning how to balance the contemporary elements, you know, all the friendships and relationships, the murder mystery elements of kind of pacing out who might be responsible for these things that are happening, and then the fantasy elements. And so, you know, it was a long process of getting all of those things to balance and hold together in a way that was meaningful for readers, so that they don't feel like they're reading two or three different books at the same time.
Right.
I see all of the elements as, you know, going together, and all of them are important to each other.
Yeah. And I mean, the trap is though that you get too crazy and it becomes, you know, it's not supposed to be believable necessarily. You have monsters in it, but even in universe, believability becomes an issue, right? Because you're like,
sure,
how could the town not be aware of any of this stuff, or, you know, whatever, right? Pick something. But I thought, you know, that of course goes back to what we were talking about earlier about picking a setting where you can sort of, you've got some room to run with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't take place downtown. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You couldn't get away with most of that stuff. So
right. Yeah. So you need isolated places.
Exactly.
But the thing is like every time I go hiking, like even to a place that, you know, I'm seeing other people, there's so much space out there. You know, it's why like some women feel comfortable hiking alone. I don't. Like, I'd love to hike alone. I really would love to, but I've never felt safe doing it. And so I always take someone with me because I'm out here and I'm pointing out into, you know, a vast open space going, this would be a perfect place to get murdered and for someone to hide our bodies.
You know, like, what? It's so funny you say that because I was just thinking, like, there's something I do all the time when I'm driving somewhere in the country. I always think to myself, that would be a great place to hide a body. Now, let me say publicly that I have never killed or hurt anybody, and I have no reason to have a place to hide a body. Let me just state that for the record. But it's weird. I think that when I see like a really thick woods and stuff, I'm like, there's got to be a body in there somewhere. I just, you know, my mind starts getting the better of me and whatever.
Well, I think it's also this idea of untamed spaces. And I mean, none of these spaces are truly untamed, but they feel that way. They feel other and they feel apart from us. And so they feel threatening. It's why if you go driving around, you know, in the Appalachian Mountains out in the middle of nowhere, and you end up on a one lane road, you start feeling really afraid because the place feels threatening. It feels other.
Is that just years of like of media, right? Like of scary stories and legends and, you know, too many movies say or whatever, right? Like, because in another context, that sounds like a beautiful, serene setting, right?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. And it can also be, you know, the time of day that you're there. True. Like,
right.
You know, during the day, it could be really beautiful and peaceful. But if you get lost at night on a country road, you might feel afraid. Or if you go, you go somewhere when it's really foggy. Like, I visited Roan Mountain when it was really, really foggy and I was alone there. And it was the most eerie, out of time experience I've had. Whereas if I'd gone at a different time of day, it would have felt pedestrian.
Well, the fog, I think, ties into this, you know, it's similar to be afraid of the dark. Like, you can't see what you can't see. Mm-hmm. If you can't see past six inches in front of your face, then your mind starts to play tricks on you. And, you know, I think we've just been conditioned to be afraid of what we can't see necessarily. Right. So it's just your mind, it's just, we're just so wired that way. And again, whether it's just inherent in us as humans or because we watch too many fucking TV shows, like I watch too much Twin Speak or something. I don't know. But anyways, yeah, it's an interesting point though. And I like, you know, thinking about that is a fun way to look at it too. You're like, in one hand, this view is gorgeous and beautiful, but then on a macro level, but then your brain switches to micro and you're starting to look for things, right? And your brain then you've lost it because your brain just takes over. But anyways, there's a lot of that in this book. I like, there's a lot of like, you know, if this was a movie, the camera would be doing a lot of forward and backwards motion, I think, with this story, right? Like, it'd be a lot of wide shots and a lot of close-up shots. I think it'd be really cool. Yeah. So this will come out around the time of the release, but July 20th this book comes out. Do you have any local stores you'd like somebody to buy this book at?
So Parnassus Books is my local independent bookstore, and they are fantastic. It's partially owned by an author, Anne Patchett.
Oh, cool.
They have signed copies of my books, and if readers pre-order from them, they'll get assigned and even a personalized copy if they want it, as well as a little bit of pre-order goodies.
Nice. It's probably early, probably don't have anything nailed down yet, but do you have any launch day funsies going on? Anything
so fun? The book is actually coming out on July 27th now. It got pushed back a week.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And so I will actually have a virtual event through Parnassus Books. So it'll just be kind of a Facebook Live event. I'll be in conversation with Wendy Hurd.
Yep.
Who's the author of She's Too Pretty to Burn.
Yep. Very cool. When did they change the date?
Very recently, like a couple of weeks ago. It was kind of a surprise.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that happens. Okay. So July 27th, then, not the 20th. So that's good to know. And Parnassus Books and everything else can be found on ericawaters.com, I assume.
Yes.
As we get closer to the events, you'll post them.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Erica, I'm sort of like, I'm a life is too short for bullshit type of person. So I really enjoyed this book. I had a great time reading it.
Thank you.
I loved all the characters in it, especially Miles.
I love hearing that you liked Miles. He's one of my favorites too.
Miles is great. They're all, Ruby's great. You know, in the leads, you've got two pretty great leads here, Natasha and Della as well. You know, any friends of sort of sapphic type stories too, I think are going to get a kick out of this book and their relationship. They're, sort of find it, they find that they have a lot more in common than they realize, and yes. strike up a nice at the bare minimum, they strike up a really great friendship, and it's a good partnership too. It's a good team, mm-hmm. Team aspect going on here. But believe me when I say we fucking just barely scratched the surface of this thing. Like it's horror and gothic and graphic and all those in the great sense of the word. And again, with the magic, you have this wonderful tie into the sort of like this ancestral root magic, and really great sensibility, and it's vivid. And again, look to this wonderful cover. There's a couple of clues on the cover, but I think there's a lot of surprises in this book, and I think a lot of people will be surprised by it. So that's my take. That's my two cents. Erica, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. If I don't talk to you before, have a great launch and a wonderful summer. And I'll hopefully be able to tune into your launch, your virtual launch.
Yeah, please do.
If you get a stupid question, then you'll know it's me. You'll be like, oh, it's Steve. Steve's here. I know.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, Erica, take care.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything's Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Erica for taking the time to speak with me. I had a great time talking The River Has Teeth, which is not only entertaining and spooky, but has a lot of important things to say. So I definitely recommend picking it up. The River Has Teeth is out now, so head on over to ericawaters.com and order yourself a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.